Nolo, your legal companion.
Hello. This week's episode is about legal issues that arise for cyclists. We're speaking with cyclist and attorney Bob Mayansky, who is a two-time Olympian and former U.S. national champion. He's the author of Bicycling and the Law, Your Rights as a Cyclist, published by Velo Press, and it's available at Amazon and at VeloGear, VeloGear.com. Bob Mayansky also runs the website BicycleLaw.com. Bob, as you know, if you're a cyclist involved in an accident, the period following the accident can be disorienting. If a cyclist had to remember just one or two things following an accident, what would those be?
The very first thing on the list would be to get the identification of the person you're involved in the accident with. Obviously, if it's a motor vehicle, you want to get the make of the car and their license plate number and any witnesses that are around there. If you don't have the identities of the players, there's two problems. One is you're not going to get a complete story, and the other more critical problem is that you won't have the responsible party's information. And I actually just had a case like this last week. The cyclist was taken off to the hospital, and the driver that hit him hung around for a bit, but he left at some point when the police were there, and the police don't know who he is, and this guy is out of bike, out of all his medical costs now.
Bob, do you have any tips about what to say or not to say after an accident?
Generally, I wouldn't engage the parties that you've been involved in the accident with because no good can come of it. And it's a highly emotionally charged atmosphere in the first place, so people tend not to be able to comport themselves and think logically, and they may say and do things which will paint them in a poor light. It doesn't change how the accident happened, but it can change how the people that are reviewing the accident determine fault.
Let's say there's an accident where the automobile driver is primarily to blame, but the bicycle rider is partially to blame. Can you explain how you deal with that in court?
Sure. In a majority of the states, we have a modified comparative negligence system. Let's say you have a two-vehicle accident. A fact finder, that being a jury or a judge, they can apportion the liability 90% on one person and 10% on the other. And that's important because when you get to the damage part of the litigation, in other words, how much has the person been put out, what's going to be necessary to make them whole, that'll be reduced by the proportionate amount of blame that is attributed to them. Now, there are a few states that have contributory negligence, and in those states, if you're found to have contributed to the accident at all, you're barred from recovery. Alabama, District of Columbia, Virginia, North Carolina has it, Maryland.
So if we have a bike tour, we should avoid those states?
You know, and North Carolina is a great place to ride, so is Maryland, and so is Virginia, and so is D.C. I don't know about Alabama, but I'm sure it is. It's beautiful northern Alabama. But let's put it this way. The jury knows that if they find the cyclist 1% to blame for the accident, that they're barring total recovery, and I think that's really helped justice in these cases.
In your book and at your website, you talk about three types of defective bicycle products, ones that are designed poorly, ones that are manufactured poorly, and ones that fail to include a warning to riders. I'm curious about the third one. Most people are familiar with bicycles and how they operate, so what is there to warn about them?
The only time I've seen it come up is in front shock cases, where you have a bike that's sold, and, you know, the price points are getting down, so they're selling these bikes at big box stores. And a person buys a bike with a shock, and they go out, and they're riding along, and they hit their front brake, and they have the shock at a very easy absorption rating. And what happens is it buries the shock, and they go over the front handlebars. And some of these are really horrible accidents. So the argument being put forth in those cases is that this is a unique piece of equipment, and it changes the way the bike functions, the way it brakes, the way the rider needs to position themselves, and at a minimum, they should be apprised of that so there's some warning about how the bike's going to handle.
One thing that may be a factor in some accidents is what you refer to as a prevailing prejudice against cyclists by motorists. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, I don't think anybody that rides a bike extensively will be surprised to learn that some people that drive vehicles don't like them, don't want to see them on the road. And I think that prejudice against cyclists stems from the competition for the roadway. You have more people riding, and the motorists have to adopt the way they drive. Even though bikes were here first, in the eye of the motorist in this motor-crazy country, more and more bikes on the road represents a threat for the space. It makes them uneasy, angry. They have to drive slower. They have to look out for them. This is really sociology.
You've written a lot about helmets and helmet laws, and I know that you've also considered a lot of the rhetoric that surrounds helmets and helmet laws as part of a political correctness approach to it. That is, an article might be written about an accident, and one of the factors that the newspaper writer will include is that the rider wasn't wearing a helmet, a factor that obviously had nothing to do with how or why the accident was caused. My guess is that if you're in court defending somebody in a bicycle accident case, your preference is going to be, because of this prejudice, that the cyclist was wearing a helmet.
Depends on the facts. You know, I think you're right, but it depends on the facts. I mean, obviously, if it goes to damages, yeah, I'm going to have to deal with that. If it has to do with who was in the right, who was it a close pass, and I'm trying to argue that my cyclist has done everything he could possibly do to make himself visible, a helmet doesn't make you visible.
Okay.
But, you know, as a practical matter, you're absolutely right. I would prefer that my clients have helmets on when I'm representing them.
There's been a lot of bicycle legislation recently, and some of it's been a little bit kooky. For example, Montana proposed that cyclists had to ride into traffic rather than with traffic. What do you do if you want to advocate about bicycle legislation? Where can you learn more?
I mean, one of the better places would be the League of American Bicyclists, and they have a webpage, and they break down the state laws, and they're also an advocacy group. So you can find out what their positions are, what laws they think are good to advocate for, and which laws need to be changed. The Thunderhead Alliance, both of those are web pages with .org after them, bikeleague.org and thunderheadalliance.org. The other way to approach it is if you feel like you want to start something yourself is find out if there's anything in your area in the way of an organization or a group that is advocating for cyclists. And if not, start one yourself. But then again, you know, refer to the national groups for direction. There's a guy in, I think it's Kansas, that had a 4-foot passing law put in as a bill and passed. So they actually have an extra foot. You know, there's several states that passed a 3-foot passing rule. Another thing that another rider did is he implored the state testing agency to include at least one bicycle-related traffic question on the driver's education written exam.
That's a great idea.
It is. You know, and for instance, in Amsterdam, you have to pass a test about cycling to get your driver's license. So, you know, it starts there.
In your book, you mention the history of bicycle laws going back over 100 years because, of course, bicycles preceded motor vehicles on the roads. Knowing what you do about the past and the history of bicycle law, what do you see for the future?
Interestingly enough, a lot of the battles that we fight right now are the same ones that they encountered a little over 100 years ago. But in terms of looking to the future, it's really hard to predict. If we look towards bike-friendly countries like Holland, Denmark, and Norway, we can see that they have all kinds of special traffic lanes and lights and laws set up for cycling to promote cycling, to protect cyclists. That's one way we can go. I mean, right now we're just trying to be able to ride safely. That's sort of a pipe dream to move that far. And furthermore, there's some division within cycling. There are those cyclists that belong to and adhere to the idea of vehicular cycling, and they don't want to see the cyclist partition. They don't want to see separate lanes because they see that as slippery slope. So when we have a divided group, it's really difficult to know where things will go in the future. But I think that more and more cycling is going to be accepted and more people are going to try it. It makes sense for so many different reasons. You know, for health and for the ecology and for cost, that it's here to stay, and hopefully it's going to continue to grow. I'm just not sure what it's going to look like in 10 or 15 years, and I hope to be a part of it.
Bob, you're located in Portland, Oregon, and that's considered to be the bike capital of the United States. Can you tell us a little bit about what it's like to operate in the bike capital?
There's a webpage called bikeportland.org, and if you go on there, it's basically news stories that involve cycling on a daily basis. They put out 4 or 5 stories a day, and it's really impressive how much of the news that happens around here involves cycling. We're like a ski town, but we're a bike town. And it's not all good news. You know, we had 7 people killed last year in the city. None of the drivers were ticketed. And the riders, we've had all kinds of protests. We have a burgeoning civil rights movement started here. All 3 mayoral candidates are running on a bike, pro-biker platform, and they're talking about another 180 miles of share roads. These are roads where they discourage the use of cars. It's low automobile traffic and truck traffic and high bike traffic. All kinds of different ideas. We have bike boxes that are going to start being painted here in the city starting this spring. And these are little boxes at the front of the queue at a red light where, you know, if the cyclists come up past the stopped cars, you get to get back in front of the cars in the blue box. And when the light turns, you get to go first. So we'll see how that flies. That may make the motorists even more angry, but it shows that there's some progression here and that there's ideas being tried. So I would say Portland is definitely the bicycle capital of the U.S. right now. A bunch of manufacturers have moved here in the last few years. We just had the custom bike show, trade show here this weekend, and they had record attendance.
What are some other bike-friendly cities in the U.S.?
There are some lists out there, and if I go by the lists, I have to say they're fairly accurate. They'd have Portland first, and then Boulder and Davis, just about the same. San Francisco comes in next. You know, who knows what the protocols are for making these determinations, but it's any city where you can ride and get to the things you want to get to on a bike.
You mentioned earlier that 7 people had been killed in Portland in bicycle accidents, yet there's so much bike-friendly legislation there. So does passing bike-friendly laws always make it safer for a bicyclist?
You know, you can pass all the laws, and you can get 4-foot passing, and you can get, we have a vulnerable user law that's just been passed here in Oregon, which will have stiffer penalties for people that injure vulnerable users of the roadway, and those would be anybody that's not in a car that's out on the road, a pedestrian, a cyclist, skateboarder, because you can skateboard in the streets here. You know, you can do these kinds of things from the government standpoint, but until you change the minds and the hearts of the public, you're not going to see a big change in the way cyclists are treated. So that's the big question in front of us, is how do we make this all work?
Bob, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Well, you're welcome.
We've been talking with Bob Mayansky, the author of Bicycling and the Law. And if you're listening to this podcast in San Francisco and it's before February 20th, 2008, then you'll be able to go see Bob. He's talking at the Treehouse Talk, which is sponsored by the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition at 995 Market Street at 6 p.m. February 20th, 2008.
Copyright by NOLO.
For over 35 years, NOLO has produced reliable, self-help legal and business books, software, and forms. Check us out on the web at www.nolo.com.
If you enjoyed this NOLO podcast, check out NOLO email newsletters. Our newsletters offer timely legal information and provide deep discounts for NOLO books and software, available to subscribers only. To sign up, go to NOLO.com and click the link labeled newsletter at the top of the page. When you subscribe, we'll give you 2 free downloadable NOLO products.
This audio program provides legal information. Consult a lawyer if you want professional assurance that the information is appropriate to your particular situation.